Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Judge David Newell of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which for our non-appellate or out-of-state listeners is Texas's highest criminal court. It's kind of the criminal equivalent of the Texas Supreme Court. Judge Newell, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. If you would, maybe just kind of give our listeners a little background on you, kind of where you're from, what you've done in your career, your path to the bench.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll try and keep it short and not ramble, but, you know, basically I was never going to be a judge or even a lawyer. I went to, you know, in high school, I was doing like musical theater and I was really into writing. That's sort of the big thing. I was a creative writer. I wrote poetry. I wrote short stories. I wrote plays. And I went to U of H, which still has a great creative writing program, but I went there to get an English degree in creative writing. And then while I was there, a friend of mine was sexually assaulted. And I didn't know how to be an ally, which we would say now, like, I wouldn't, you know, you'd be an ally. You didn't know how to do it. I responded the way any guy would. It's just, I was just angry. And then I realized that's not helpful. So I volunteered at the Houston Area Women's Center for about a year, handling their rape crisis hotline. I was one of many. I wasn't running the whole thing. I was just like, I volunteered to answer the phones every week or whatever. And I realized quickly that that wasn't going to make a big difference in anyone's, I wasn't going to make a big difference in anyone's life writing haiku about crushed red pepper, you know, like, so I decided, which I did win a contest though for, by the way, I realized that if I wanted to make a difference in people's lives, or I really want to help people like my friend, I should go into law. And so that's what I did. I went to law school to become a prosecutor. I went to UT. I graduated from U of H. I went to UT. And then I came right back home to Fort Bend, which is where I grew up, really. I mean, I was born in Bethesda, Maryland, but I grew up, I went to high school in Clements High School in Fort Bend, Sugar Land. And I was a prosecutor there for about 10 years. I started on the line like everyone else, but I had background in writing and I was a teaching quiz master at UT, I started volunteering doing appellate briefs. And so I did a lot of appellate briefs until they created a position for me to just do criminal appeals. And then after being there for about 10 years, I went to the Harris County District Attorney's Office. And I'm just doing solely criminal appeals at that point. And I handled, so the thing I always tried to do was whatever they needed me to do, I would do. Like I have, like I joke about this, but it's sadly not a joke, but it's, I have like boundary issues. Like, hey, please do this. I'm like, oh, okay, sure. I'll figure it out. I don't know what quorum nobis means, but so I did that. And then around 2013, it became obvious that three judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals were stepping down. And I had been doing presentations for the state bar and for the Texas District Attorney's Association on case law from the United States Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And I was very familiar with the Court of Criminal Appeals. And I wanted there to be some continuity. We were losing Judge Kathy Cochran, who passed away recently, an incredible voice on the court, an incredible light, you know, and not to suggest that others weren't great, but, you know, that's the kind of thing you want to keep that continuity. And so I was like, well, someone needs to run. So I went to my boss. I said, you should run. And he did not listen to me. So I went ahead and we had a meeting with my family. We had a family meeting where we talked about what we were going to do because it's a statewide election. I've never run for anything. I don't really think of myself as a politician. And my younger son, who was, I want to say about 10, said, you know, Dad, I was scared to run for student council, but I did it. And I was like, well, thanks. So I threw my hat in the ring and first election ever. And I won actually at the general election. I got in the state. I got the second highest number of votes in Texas. And then just recently I was reelected. Actually, just recently I was reelected in a very contentious general election with massive turnout, actually. And actually I got the most votes in history for my court. So yeah, thank you. Yeah. Jane Bland had more votes than me though. So she's doing something really, really well. And but I'm close. I'm close. So higher winning percentage, I think, higher voter percentage, but still, I'm not good with math. So. But that's what led me here. And I guess to sort of say I'm not just some, hey, I threw my name in the hat. I am board certified in criminal law and criminal appellate law. So, I mean, this is not something that I hope that I'm good at. This is something I do have a lot of experience in. So.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
We've talked a lot about judicial kind of selection and election in Texas. How was it going from essentially a very non-political position at the DA's office to running for a statewide political office?
It was a nightmare. The mistake that I made, actually, it's funny, is like this. Remember, the first time I'm running is around the same time that House of Cards is hitting its second season. And everyone who's involved in politics is like watching this. And I'm relating to Corey Stoll, you know, the Pennsylvania senator, going like, I'm going to be killed in someone's car. it was a very, very stressful environment. And not to take away from the fact that I meet plenty of really wonderful people out on the trail and on both sides of the political spectrum. But at the same time, politics is about the perception is reality, you know, and in a race like the Court of Criminal Appeals, there's not a lot of money. There's really not a lot of that. And so what other people are doing to sort of characterize you and how they frame you and how they look at you becomes who you are seen as. And it's not necessarily true. And it can be very, very frustrating because you sit there and you go, and the thing I also had a friend that actually went into politics a little bit a while ago. And he said, what do you think about it? And I was like, you can have the most stressful day where nothing happens. Like you can spend the whole day just thinking something, you know, and talking to people and clarifying that nothing is really going on. And then nothing happens. And that's a good day. Like that's ultimately like a good thing. You know, so the general sense is that, you know, you have to deal with politics. I'm naive in this. My father is a Naval Academy graduate and like, he's my idol. He's a guy I look up to. And he's always just sort of been like, you just got to be who you are. You got to stand up for who you are. And they raised me with the idea that you just got to do a good job. You know, like people really just want someone who's going to do a good job. Like there's a lot of labels and things like that, but at the end of the day, there's always work for good people. If you work really hard, you do a good job, that's the best you can give people. And that's what that's sort of the way that I tried to leaven out all the politics that can be very, very all the noise, all the political noise, to just try and focus on, I'm just going to try and do a good job and be the best judge that I can be. It was a real culture shock. It really was. So.
And as we've seen, you can do a really good job and you might not keep your job. For reasons having nothing to do with your performance.
Right, right. That's exactly right.
We're certainly happy that you were able to be reelected and can visit with us today. So congratulations on that and the stellar numbers that rolled in. Next time around, maybe you'll be able to shoot for Judge Bland and see.
In numbers, not against her.
Exactly. I would never do that. I'm a team player, man. Rising tide lifts all boats. We, you know, that's me. I'm happy for her to have better numbers than me. And I think that she's great. I actually appeared in front of her once as an advocate. That's sort of the other cool thing about this is that I went from being this advocate. I appeared in front of Bill Boyce, Jeff Brown, Tracy Christopher, and Jane Bland are people that I actually argued in front of. And now I'm like, wow, they talk to me at parties, you know, like they know who I am. I'm like, they're going to, at any point, it's sort of total imposter syndrome. At any point, they're going to be like, well, you shouldn't have let that guy.
I'm kind of hoping that this podcast does the same for me and Jody, you know, that judges will talk to us at parties.
Absolutely. I see what you're doing. You're breaking in the back door, man.
That's right. Well, of course, the downside of that is then Todd and I actually have to talk to people at parties. So I don't know, it may backfire on us.
Well, you know, appellate practitioners aren't necessarily known for being gregarious, I guess.
That's right.
This is true. There are a few exceptions, but this is absolutely true. So Your position with the Harris County DA, I mean, that must have been a lot of fun for you, being able to work on criminal appeals, you know, all day, every day. And did you have any ability to pick and choose what you were doing, or were you just like the guy? And anytime there was an appeal, it came across your desk.
I was never the guy. Like the thing that was really great about, I was the guy. I was more like the guy in Fort Bend, but I worked with John Harity, who's the chief in Fort Bend, who is another great mentor of mine. And I think very highly of. In Harris County, however, there's just chock full of people that are just so talented. They've been there for a while. And so they just randomly assign stuff. I learned a lot from all the people that were there. And they just, the only time they would sort of assign stuff or really kind of assign stuff is like someone had an expertise in, say, Padilla claims, you know, which is the United States Supreme Court case that says you have to instruct accurately regarding immigration consequences before you plead your client out, and you're ineffective if you fail to do so. Well, that was a big deal in across the country. And so one attorney who's handling these appeals ended up sort of getting a lot of these things because there were just going to be so many of them. So that was basically it. But I got a wide smattering of a lot of different things. You know, they'll say you're on a rotation, you would get your death penalty cases, you're getting the next death penalty case, and then you're getting this, you know, you get search cases, adult-oriented businesses cases. Like there's lots of great stories that you get from these things, but also there's a lot of really emotional things you have to deal with. Like one of the things that, like, if you're as an advocate, sort of from an advocate standpoint, when you write a brief, you kind of want to tell your story, a story in your facts. You typically want to do that. So in the adult-oriented business case, I had to sort of describe this building that had become this adult arcade. And it was really one of the most disgusting things I've ever had to write. It was just so you get cases like that, but then you also get other cases that are a much more dire consequences that are very, very, very tough. Part of the thing, actually, another thing in the Harris County that I did love was a lot of the lawyers. I loved it because the lawyers would come in and ask me, what are we going to do? What should we do here? Ask me for legal advice. And I would go down and I would appear in many of those death penalty cases and things like that to handle some of the more legal arguments. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up having to not participate in a lot of the cases that came before the Court of Criminal Appeals, like the death penalty case with Bobby Moore, actually, which is a mental retardation case where the court, it's ping pong back and forth. That was a case that was assigned to me as a writ attorney. So I was like not able to participate in it. So I got to do a lot of different stuff. I guess the big answer is that I got to do a lot of different things, and it was all relatively random.
Among DA's offices, I assume having that sort of specialized appellate division is really concentrated in the more urban areas. I think we've learned from talking with some other folks that in the rural areas, they obviously just don't have the personnel and the funding to do that. But I would imagine that your plate was full in Harris County with that whole office. That's a really neat opportunity, it seems like, for I will say, a young budding appellate lawyer to come up and really get some great experience. I mean, you being board certified both in criminal law and criminal appellate law, you know, had to be a really good thing for you, unless, I don't know the timing on that, if you did that since getting to the court or before, but you certainly would have had the experience to do it.
Before. It was before. I would be remiss if I didn't sort of emphasize too, I was there in Harris County. You know, one of the sort of interesting things about Harris County was that I wanted to go to a place, this was right after Johnny Holmes, Chuck Rosenthal taken over. And I thought this is going to be stable. And then I went through like 7 DAs. Like it was really an interesting sort of time and upheaval, and you kind of want to keep your head down and stuff. But at the same time, one of the other things that was really neat is they created the Public Defender's Office in Harris County. And to speak to the idea of the experience that you get doing something like that, you're going up against really, really talented defense attorneys that are very, very top of their game as well. So it's not just that I'm working with colleagues that are really, really good, you know, working under Alan Curry or with Eric Kugler, but I'm also getting to go up against attorneys like Janie Wood, who is just a phenomenal appellate advocate. And, you know, and also on the private side, I have to face off against Brian Weiss or Carmen Rowe. And these are just phenomenal appellate people as well. And it's like, you have to bring your A game anytime. And so it really did help a great deal. And so that's why I was able, I mean, I got board certified in criminal law because I had a background in, I had enough of a background in trial that I could do that in 2004 or 2006. I can't remember. And then right when they offered the criminal appellate thing, I signed up and did that. So Yeah, I tried to get as much. I have a hard time saying no. And so I have boundary issues, and I'm happy to sort of take up any challenge if it'll help people. So
you'd mentioned death penalty cases. We had someone from the state prosecuting attorney's office on a couple of months ago. How much of your practice was in the CCA at the Harris County DA's office, and how much of it was in their intermediate, or did it kind of vary?
You know, that was the thing that I've looked back on, and having been on the court now, I actually was pretty lucky that I got to go up to the Court of Criminal Appeals a lot more than a lot of people do. I mean, I want to say like I had 6 or 7 cases that had gone up there and I thought, well, that's not that much, you know, but then I look at other people and they're like, this is my first time, like really experienced people. They're like, this is my first time getting up here. And I had a lot more experience getting up there for Ben than I did from Harris County. There was a lot of interesting issues that I could dig into that got me up there. But from that, I always say that one skill that I got is that I'm good at issue spotting, and I'm good at sort of making those issues sexy so that someone will bite off of them. And that's John. If you were to referring to John Messenger, who's a friend of mine, he's very good at that too. Like he's very good at crafting these really sexy kind of hooks. He's like Bruno Mars in that regard of appellate law. I mean, it's like, oh yeah. It's like, don't believe me, just watch. And so I got good at that. And so I did have a lot of experience with that, but a lot more of it obviously was going to be at the regular appellate level. But I did, because of transfer cases, I was lucky enough to also get the ability to appear before like the 13th Court of Appeals. I had one in front of the 6th. I got a broad base of sort of experience to do some of those things, but primarily was in the 1st and the 14th. So
we enjoyed visiting with John when he was on the show, and we learned so much about the state prosecuting attorney's office and had no idea how that all worked. I mean, the civil appellate lawyers, the closest analog we had was the Solicitor General's office, but it was just quite fascinating to hear about how that whole process works with the SPA and the relationship with the CCA, and just really neat.
The thing that I sort of envy for him and is he's able to sort of look at everything that's going on at the Court of Appeals level. They're very careful about these are the things that are coming up, and they do a lot of that kind of advising. I mentioned earlier, like trial attorneys would come into my office in Harris County to ask me about what to do. Well, it's like that for him, except people from all over the state are doing that and saying, well, what do you think about this? What do you think we should bring this up? Is this going to be a problem later? And it's kind of a sweet gig. I think there's a little bit of a push to create a defense analog, which obviously I think that's not a bad idea either. I don't want to go on too much, but the public defender's office in Harris County has been, I think, a good thing. You know, I think it's been a really, really good thing. And when I got up to Austin in Travis County, it's like it didn't seem like they had something like that. And it looks like they're trying to move that direction. And I think that those are all for the good. I think those are all for the good and the benefit of the court system as a whole.
What was it like kind of coming from a DA's office perspective and then going on to discretionary review criminal high court? Was it sort of a culture shock, or did you feel like you adjusted quickly?
I'm glad you asked that. It was, they asked me that when I was running, like, are you just going to be another prosecutor on the bench? It is a completely different experience. Like, I did not realize how much goes into the decision-making at that level. I always sort of think of it in terms of being an advocate. It's like, there's a blessed simplicity to being an advocate because my side's the one, you know, like that's sort of the thing. It's like, you're like, I have a position and this is it. And that's all you have to really focus on to make that argument. But when you're on the court, there are so many layers to the way that you look at that beyond just the one issue. You got, well, how is this going to play on this other context? And you're having to do all of that. You know, one of the things that's great about just sort of analogy to the legislature is the legislature can have hearings. They can bring in stakeholders from all over so that they can at least come to a better conclusion as to how something's going to play across the entire state and get a bunch of different perspectives. But when you're a court, and you're just a judge, you have to try and do that all in your head, and you have to rely on the advocates to give you stuff, and you try to focus on the task at hand, but also be mindful of how it's going to echo into other areas of law. You actually have to consider the institutional credibility of the court. You know, that's another thing too. It's like one of the things that I learned was the legislature gets its power because it has purse strings. Executive branch has power because it can enforce laws. Courts really exist on their credibility. If you don't make good decisions, people start saying we need to pack the court, or we need to fire one member of the court or something like that, or multiple members. You know, that's what they start doing. They lose trust in the institution. And that's another big thing that you have to do and keep in mind when you're making these decisions. Even if you're like, well, I can see what this is, but I question whether or not this is going to result in a loss of credibility for the institution. Things like, and that's where things like stare decisis becomes a big deal. Actually, I've been really weighing with the idea of stare decisis. And I was just thinking about it, like stare decisis, the big side effects of that is that it gives credibility to an institution. Like you're connected to all of these other cases and everyone has come to rely on them. If you're going to switch course, you can't just do it in the back room. You have to explain why you're going to do it. And you have to explain why it's better to go this other path. And then when you do that, that's the most credibility you can get, having acknowledged that you've made a mistake or that someone previously made a mistake.
I would think in criminal law in particular, that's especially important because the impact of changing rules and things like that and, you know, settled law and that stuff is just enormous.
You got a little different issue than, say, the Texas Supreme Court with the overlay of all the constitutional questions that come. I mean, the Texas Supreme Court doesn't cite U.S. Supreme Court cases all that often, whereas I think in the Court of Criminal Appeals, you know, you got basic Fourth Amendment stuff, for example. You have to maintain faithfulness to those authorities too, you know, not just the CCA's previous decisions as well.
That's right. I've always said too, like one of the things I find really fascinating about the job that I like is that I always feel like I'm in a conversation with the United States Supreme Court. There's so much of our case law is, and I mean, not to harp on not one of our better moments, the court's better moments, but you know, in the Bobby Moore case, which I had to sit and watch like a slow motion car wreck because I couldn't actually participate in it. Basically, it's like, well, we would say something to the United States Supreme Court. They say, do this again. So, you know, you're having this interaction with them that is, it almost feels like you're writing letters to them and they're writing letters back to you. And I think it's really neat to feel that way. I think that the danger is feeling like if you're that close to the sun, you are the sun. And it's like, you're not at all. We are just below that. And they call the tune. And even if I don't like it, I've said on many occasions, like, I don't like this opinion. I don't like this opinion. I think that what they're doing is wrong, but I don't get to say that. I don't get to question them because they're the last word, and they are the last authority, the final authority on that.
Well, and I feel like your cases from the Court of Criminal Appeals are far more likely to warrant their attention than your average case from the Texas Supreme Court, too, just because of those issues that are involved.
Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting to me, speaking of the Supreme Court, too, is I've had to go through, like, remember I mentioned that I wanted continuity when I started, and what I've experienced for the last 6 years, and I may be experiencing in the next term, every 2 years, our court has been churning through new judges. Like our court has just changed the makeup completely. You know, now I'm in the middle. I started off being the youngest. I was literally, this is a little bit dishonest to say this, like I was placed 9 and I came in at the same time as Judge Erie and Judge Richardson, and they drew lots to find who was going to be the least senior judge, right? And I wasn't there for the drawing, but amazingly enough, somehow Richardson, who is the elder statesman and higher up on the placement, he becomes the most senior. And then Judge Erie, who is one like a little bit less old, but also a little bit lower on the number, place 4, he's the next guy. And then I'm number 9 and I'm the youngest and I'm the least senior. And so I feel that the fix was in on that, but they like, now I'm in the squarely in the middle. Like I'm squarely in the middle of the court. I've watched them do this. And the point I was trying to get back to, or I need to get back to, is that the Supreme Court is going through that too. Like the Supreme Court is really, I'm watching them do their thing going, I know what that conference was like. I know what went down. You know, it's like, you see it. And it's been kind of interesting, and I feel for them, but they've done it on a slow motion. They've done a more slow motion kind of thing because it hasn't been as drastic of the changes as we've had to deal with. Because we had, 3 new judges the first year I got there, then 2 new judges, then 1 new judge. But the opinions from the United States Supreme Court, particularly in federal constitutional law, are sort of moving goalposts without sort of telling us to do that. I say that with giving full rights to Schadenfreude or for all the people that have to look at my opinions or our opinions and everything. But it's true. It's like they're doing these things and then we're going, well, we gotta address it. But I mean, like the cell site location information and the third party record doctrine with regard to the Fourth Amendment they had this case called Carpenter's. Great case. I think it's very, very fascinating. But it's like, you guys just the previous year denied cert on another case out of our court on cell site location information. And now Carpenter comes out afterwards and we have to adjust. And they're doing things like that in a lot of different areas. And it's really affecting our court a lot because we're having to sort of catch up to the way that the new judges, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and those guys, are thinking about it. We have no clue what Amy Coney Barrett's going to be like, but you know, you've already seen the change with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. So it makes for interesting work. So I guess is the way to look at it.
Were you going to say something, Todd? Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to ask what I think might be kind of a funny question, which is, does the junior judge on the CCA have to get coffee for everyone?
You know, it's funny. No, but I did have to hold the door for everybody because I was the guy that had to open. I would go in first and hold the door, or go out first and hold the door. I had to do that. There were some sort of traditions like that, but not many. And unfortunately for me, it was only 2 years, and I quickly passed that off to other people. I will say this, the people that are sitting on either end of the bench, they have fake drawers. Okay, so that was one thing. Like they have, I was at my seat in oral argument, the drawer will not come out because it's not even a drawer. It just looks like a drawer. And so I hurt my fingers many times trying to open a drawer, but now I have a drawer. So those are the kinds of things. But I mean, if you look at our robing room and all this kind of stuff, we are very much like, I always like to joke that we're kind of like the potluck court because, you know, you go out with, we've periodically gotten together with the Supreme Court of Texas and not them at all. But it's like, they're, well, let's go to this nice place. Yeah, it's great. And then when our suggestion is, well, we should get together, we're like, well, we'll bring, oh, what do you want to bring? Oh, we'll bring this. And I think that that's also, though, I think there's a positive thing to that, too. I think it's great that they have that experience. And I think that it's great that we can sit there and be like, we're much more of a rough and tumble family kind of group dynamic. And we get together. But that's, yeah, it's not, we're trying to be a little bit more tradition and starting traditions and everything. So, but it's hard when you keep moving through different judges and then history is lost. So I guess you tear your history down, man, as Eddie Izzard says, you know, this house has been here for 50 years, you know, like in, except in Europe, it's like thousands of years, you know.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. And very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. You'd mentioned in when you signed up to be on the podcast a couple of cases that you wanted us to ask you about. So if you have a few minutes, I'd like to hear about them. You'd mentioned Ex parte Mayhew was one of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Ex parte Mayhew is a case that it was I'm very proud of. This is, if you're not familiar with, there's a lot more true crime podcasts. There's a lot of true crime documentaries that are out there. I mean, one of the more recent ones a lot of people are familiar with is Outcry on Showtime. But there was a documentary called Southwest of Salem about four women in Bear County who were wrongfully accused of sexual assault because one of the, I think, ex-husbands of one of the women was diabolical, or maybe that's too pejorative. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but he was definitely manipulating things to try and get the women in trouble and basically pressured two girls to make false allegations against these women. And they're featured in this whole documentary, so it's a fairly high-profile case. And we had the case. I wrote this case to talk about. I wrote the lead opinion on it, sort of exonerating them and recognizing actual innocence and recognizing sort of the idea that it's important. I mean, the big thing that I brought to this, the thing I'm the most proud of, because when I read the record and I looked at everything and involved in the case, the one thing that really just struck me is that a lot of times these actual innocence cases seem to have an undercurrent of so-and-so is going to get paid, so-and-so is getting compensated by the government. And so maybe the hint is, or the perception is, that that weighs into the decision-making. And the thing that I recognized was, I think that we are looking at that the wrong way. I think that the real thing should be is, look, these people who are innocent, who have been convicted, want their name cleared. And you need to have a judge specifically, you need to have a court be able to say specifically, you are innocent. You know, and this comes at a time where other members of the court are saying, well, we need to raise the definition. We shouldn't declare someone innocent unless they've proven their innocence, which is impossible. I get at that point in the process, you'll always be able to point to, well, a jury found this, these people guilty. This new evidence has come in and it's going to, you know, it undermines it. But at the same time, you're just saying they're not guilty. You're not saying they're innocent. And I'm like, you're never going to try. As a practical matter, I've said in another opinion, I don't think that you could practically retry someone who has met the burden they need to meet in order to find or to be found actually innocent. So we should be just doing that. We should, the courts should be in the business of saying, we're going to declare you innocent so that these people could, you can never make their lives whole, but it's, they've spent all this time in prison for something they didn't do. And the government was responsible for that. So it's a terrible thing. And I'm not trying to cast aspersions on any of the players, but it's like, once you get to that stage where someone is innocent, we should be in the process of saying, you know, they've met their burden, just like the state meets their burden to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. If they've met their burden to show someone is innocent, actually innocent on the writ of habeas corpus, then we should be saying they're actually innocent because they're getting a new trial and there's a presumption of innocence and we should be treating that way. And that's something I'm very proud of. That's something that means a lot to me because I'm afraid to meet. This is the thing too, is like people are like, do you want to meet the San Antonio Four, the women that did this? And I'm like, well, they're way, no, I would stand in a, I'm doing it now. I'm just even the thought of it. I'm babbling. I'm just literally babbling. I would sit in a corner and I would say, nice shoes. You know, I would not, these people are heroes. Like I can imagine the character of people that would go to jail knowing that they're innocent and spending 10 years or so and having the opportunity to get out if they just sort of confess, and they wouldn't do it. They absolutely wouldn't do it. They insisted that they were innocent the entire time. I'm just kind of in awe of that. You know, I'm not that special. I always say that this is a rambling thing, I guess, when I'm getting far afield, but when I would lecture or when I present to prosecutors on ethics and how to be a good prosecutor, I always bring back things to the Milgram experiment, the Milgram psychological experiment. If you're familiar with that, that's the experiment where someone would come in and volunteer to press a button while someone in another room would pretend to receive electric shocks. And the person pressing the button was the subject, right? And so they would do it, and the study would show that the person would get the electric shock, and they would hear the actor in the background shouting like they were being like tortured. And eventually everyone would go, I can't do this anymore. I can't. And then someone would come out with a clipboard and a white coat and say, don't worry, you're not responsible. We can do it. And then the crazy thing is the statistics, there was like several people that were like, they were shocking the person after they thought the person was dead. And I'm like, but one guy walked out, you know, and I always say like, that's what you have to be like. Like if you need to be ethical, you should be the person that would walk out of Milgram. You should be, they should put that on your grave. You should always aspire to that. And we're all flawed people. And I know that may be an impossible task, but at least if you strive for it, you're going to be better. And that's the kind of character that you see in those folks that were exonerated. And so it was a really, really big, a big emotional case for me. I can't imagine what, I mean, not to take their story though, you know, but I'm proud of that legal observation that I made, which meant something. So still battling it out though, still battling that issue. So
you had also mentioned Milton versus State. Oh,
this one actually got a little bit of coverage across the country because this is a situation where a prosecutor, and he's very creative. I feel terrible because I've had to educate people in this case. And I don't want to trash, I don't mean to embarrass this prosecutor, but basically you had a case where a guy robbed someone. It's a robbery. Like the difference between robbery and aggravated robbery is that aggravated robbery is dangerous because someone has a gun or they're going to try. But robberies, you threaten to kill someone, but it's not as assaultive or you don't cause serious bodily injury. And this guy walked into a CVS and he engages in the least violent robbery you could imagine. Like literally, on the surveillance video, you see people lining up behind him to check out while he is holding up the CVS, okay? But he has a lot of criminal offenses in his past that are not violent. They're not necessarily violent, but they're dishonest. He's a thief more than he's a robber, right? And so prosecution gets a conviction, rightly so. They get to the punishment phase. And when they do this, they decide, the prosecutor says, I want to offer this video, which was a viral video. And if you're on Facebook, I know a lot of people aren't necessarily on Facebook. If you go on Facebook and hit the GIF button and enter lion eating a baby, you'll see the picture of this viral video. And he put this video on to the jury and said, now, I know what you're saying. What was that all about? And the video was of a lioness in a zoo behind plexiglass trying to just get you know, trying to open their mouth and bite this small child who's sitting on the other side of the plexiglass, oddly enough, dressed like a zebra. Like, I don't know why, if you're a parent, you're going to dress your child in a zebra coat. Why? I don't know. But they're videotaping the whole thing. And the lion's going for it. Like, the lion is not just sort of casually like, I'm kind of hungry. No, he's like pawing at the thing. I mean, he's just really vicious. And the argument from the prosecutor was, if you remove that glass, it's a tragedy. And so that's why you need to lock this guy up, because he's done all of these things in the past, and you should lock him up because otherwise he's going to commit more crimes. You know, and the obvious thing that we ended up saying in the opinion is, well, there's no evidence that he wanted to eat a child. And the video carries with it this great potential to show, to get the jury to think that the crime was worse than it was. This guy is, now maybe if this is a really bad capital murder, then maybe that would be something that you would consider. But the video was just a little too much. It just went too far. And the thing that, but the side note from an appellate nerd geeky standard is that this opinion, when I got it assigned to me, I was lucky. They randomly assigned cases at the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so I was lucky enough to get this one. I went through several different agencies to create our media page. So the Court of Criminal Appeals actually has a media page now, and we put a link to the video so that everyone can see that video. And also we wrote the opinion for the screen. There's all the talk about slip opinions and publications and things like that. Well, this is one, my thought was, this is obviously going to be something that everyone is going to read. They're going to read it when they go to our court's website. And so there's a hyperlink in the opinion that you can click on, and it will take you right to the video and you'll get to watch it. And it also includes the site. The Supreme Court did something like that. They actually did their own media page with a car chase, but they didn't have a hyperlink to it. And so we actually did that. And we also embedded pictures from the exhibit. And so it's a real groundbreaking sort of moment as far as technology in the courtroom. And it's also, I think, a pretty good opinion, because no one had ever said, well, what do you use as an exhibit, a demonstrative exhibit, in closing argument? And so I'm very proud of that as an innovative thing that we did. And it's also a much more lighthearted story than, you know, some of the other cases that you have to deal with. So I thought that you might enjoy that. So
yeah,
absolutely.
But yeah, it did get a copy of in the, there's a couple of news articles like going, why would you put that on there? But sometimes we get carried away, I guess. And so, but that's a big technology in the courtroom case. And it's one I think that hopefully will have some legs as far as precedent is concerned.
On the subject of technology in the courtroom and videos, let's talk a little bit about Zoom and the pandemic and how your court adapted to that.
Do we want to talk about Watkins before we move on?
We can talk about Watkins versus State. That's another one you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. That's one that just came out. It's a 7-2 decision. And this is one of these opinions that I'm very proud to have been able to work on. But it was also one that I did a lot of work on to win, in the sense that the case wasn't originally assigned to me. I wrote a dissent that persuaded other people. The case ended up coming to me, and then I turned a very fractured decision from the court, what would have been a very fractured decision from the court, into a 7-2 opinion with very, very clear guidance on criminal discovery. As a prosecutor, it's more like, I want to turn everything over for you, but I also don't want to be tagged for having failed to turn over something I had no idea I even had or should have turned over. And that's sort of the tension with discovery. That's really what I see going on in criminal discovery, at least from my perspective. But we actually recognize that the Michael Morton Act, Article 3914 in the Code of Criminal Procedure, has completely revamped criminal discovery. And I'm very proud of how it works a lot of things into it to sort of explain. Like, 3914 was originally passed to mirror civil discovery. And for whatever reason, the court decided to go with a materiality concept to determine what the word material meant. And that made it much harder for the defense to actually get stuff. There was, for a long time, there was a limited right of discovery. In fact, if you go back to 65, when they passed this, the prevailing theory was, it's bad to disclose things because then the defense can then manufacture evidence, and it's better for the truth-finding function for the prosecution to be able to keep stuff close to the chest. And I think that over time, we have seen that's just not accurate. Like, it's much more efficient to turn more things over. It does encourage more pleas. You know, the recommendations through a lot of cases has been, there's got to be an open file policy and all that. But they didn't require it. But now with the new statute, this opinion has sort of recognized this statutory right to discovery that's far broader than what due process requires. It was a simple case with punishment evidence where the defense asked for notice of punishment evidence. The state says, we're going to introduce all sorts of extraneous offenses, but then they never showed them the exhibits. And so we had to look at all this previous case law that had interpreted 3914 and say whether or not we were going to apply it or not. And sort of a hidden gem in it from an appellate practitioner standpoint is it sort of recognizes the presumption of the prior construction canon for statutory analysis, which is if there's been a clear understanding of what the term meant and the legislature didn't fix it, then the legislature intended, we presume the legislature intended that interpretation. And this is a rare case where you can say, look, the case law isn't all that clear, and the legislature has changed the statute to some degree, so we can't presume that. So there has to be, it says clearly there has to be an authoritative definition from the past for the legislature to rely on. And so that's one of the little hidden things in there that I like, but I'm very proud of it because it sort of does what I think the court probably should have done in 1965 and just say, look, here's discovery is like civil discovery, and that's what we're supposed to treat it like. But now with this new statute, there's this clean break going forward. I know that it has led to a lot of changes. A lot of people are really turning a lot more stuff over. So I'm very happy about that. But to prosecutors that don't like it, you know, the thought is, well, if you're doing an open file policy anyway, this opinion won't affect you at all. It's just really it really comes down to when you fail to disclose something. And there's other issues that you're going to have to answer. But ultimately, it just says if it's likely that you're going to introduce it, if it's relevant evidence, it should be turned over. You should just turn it over. One of the judges says that she thinks that this is going to be the most important case I ever wrote. And so it may very well be. It's all downhill from here, I guess.
Raised your pinnacle already, Judge.
I peaked. Now I just need to stay out of everyone's way.
Well, you hit on something there briefly that I think is kind of a really important thing that we've touched on in this podcast before. Your court really does have the opportunity in some situations to provide a lot greater rights than due process requires, whether through legislative or whether through, you know, Texas constitutional law. And that's one of those kind of unique little interesting things that people sometimes forget about when you're talking about a state high court.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that I thought was really, I did sort of understand the pushback on the case, but that was one of the things I thought was like, this is a brand new statute. If the legislature wants to grant greater rights, they can. And we just need to recognize it. Why would we try and interpret the statute in a way to do the opposite? We have fights over whether the Texas Constitution provides greater rights. And that's something that's actually been funny. I don't know what y'all will think about it, but on that issue, a lot of people tend to think, look, the Texas Constitution, the federal Constitution is the floor and the Texas Constitution is the ceiling. And there's another theory that has been floated of, well, it's a floor. The Texas Constitution is a floor or a ceiling, but it's in a different house. So it doesn't really, yeah, I know. And so I thought about that. I'm like, well, it seems to make some sense when you think about it. But then I went and looked at the supremacy clause. And then I was like, no, I don't think that you can do that. The supremacy clause specifically says you can't provide less rights in your state constitutions than the federal constitution provides. So that's sort of the thing I see. But you're right. It is an interesting opportunity where we could provide greater rights. And perhaps we could do that a little bit more. And Watkins was a situation where we sort of did recognize that.
This is an area where the United States Supreme Court can't touch you.
Right. If you provide greater rights, then they can't do anything because it's an independent state ground. But I mean, there's a case called Michigan versus Long. I think it's Michigan versus Long. And that was a situation where the state constitution allowed for a particular search and they said no. But the question was sort of how involved is the state constitution? And so I think the pushback is, well, if the state constitution is really involved, it's really a state law issue. And I'm like, I still think that you're going to have that goes back to the Articles of Confederation. You know, it's like the whole idea behind a centralized constitution was that you can't have states doing less than the federal constitution. But I mean, I suppose there's also wiggle room for like Texas has a lot of unique provisions that have no analog in the federal constitution. Like our separation of powers clause is unique. And so it's like in that situation, that really seems like that has to be a purely state law issue. But you know, I don't know. The Supreme Court's changing all the time, so I don't know what they want. So.
We had talked a little bit about technology in the courtroom. How did your court adapt, and how were your experiences with Zoom and the pandemic and all that?
I think that the Zoom experience has been pretty good. Actually, my wife works at Baker Botts, so I hear some of the civil side from her. It has really changed a kind of a culture in law. Generally, like you don't have to be in have FaceTime. You don't have to have literal FaceTime in the office. You can do more telecommuting and the system works. It's more like we only need meeting rooms and stuff like that. And I think that our our court is very much like a monk-like existence anyway. There's not a lot of front-facing stuff for me. Like I tend people like, well, you're kind of weird. You do all sorts of things in presentation. I'm like, oh, but that's because I'm not a judge. Like the only time I'm really a judge is when I put on the robe at oral argument or when I write an opinion. You know, that's the way I sort of look at, I'm front-facing then. And we have adapted very well to that one thing. I think that it works pretty well. We have a little bit of a, obviously we have a little bit of the talking over each other problem, but we've managed to work it out. I'm the biggest offender. They all hate me and they're right to. I'm not even saying like, I'm saying this with shame. I'm saying this with absolute shame. I just jump in there with stuff and then I have to go, I'm sorry. But generally we're able to get questions out without interrupting each other. We're able to feed off of each other and ask questions, and it works pretty well. It's been very good with oral argument. If there was a challenge to us in the pandemic, it was probably the ransomware attack more than anything else. One of the things that was, I joke about, there was basically exactly for us, it was like exactly like Apollo 13. The entire court climbed into the limb and we had to go for like 3 weeks sitting in the limb, except there was no heroism and no space and no, and no Tom Hanks. But it was, other than that, it was exactly like that. Like it literally, and it wasn't even our fault. The thing that I love is that our court was great. We're kind of behind the curve on technology in that we still agree with paper. And that's a valid thing, but we handed out paper. We don't use Thames or Ames the way that the courts of appeals do. We have a server and everything is in folders. And so everything was not corrupted in the same way. So it was just that we couldn't get to it. But for like 3 weeks, I was getting on OneDrive and uploading everything that we were going to talk about for conference so that everyone had access to it so that we knew what we were talking about. We only really missed one conference. It took us one conference to go, well, what are we doing? What do we have? And then by the next conference, we were back to normal. And that happened for about 3 weeks is where we were really sort of in a pinch, but we made it work. And but it was more of a challenge than just getting on Zoom and meeting with each other. The only other challenge with Zoom actually had to do with one of our judges is a little bit elderly and he's concerned about his health. And so you didn't want to bring in everyone for an in-person meeting when one judge doesn't necessarily feel safe doing that. And so we've had a few in-person meetings. We've tried to do one in-person meeting a month since April. So we've just did our second one and we will meet and talk about opinions, but then we also don't want to risk, we don't want to make anyone on our staff uncomfortable. So then we would retreat to our chambers and do Zoom with the central staff. And that's the way that the system is set up. If the Court of Criminal Appeals has a large central staff, because we have so many cases coming at us, they work the cases up. And so in addition, all the pleadings and everything that we get to see, we also get a memo from the attorneys. And then they can come in and talk to us about writs and PDRs. And that's the part of the conference they're involved in. But we have done those still by Zoom. We're targeting coming back in September to full yeah status, as they say in Say Anything. And we'll be all together now, as the Beatles might say. But so far, the Zoom thing has worked pretty well. Like it's you know, the problem is too, some people that are not as comfortable with it, so they fade out. But generally, we've adapted and it has worked pretty well, I think.
I know that there have been courts that have experimented and done pretty successfully civil jury trials over Zoom. I know there's kind of some unique issues in the criminal context. Are you aware if courts have tried doing criminal jury trials?
I am aware that they've tried doing that. Part of the interesting, it's a little bit of a side note, you know, all the emergency orders came out and a lot of the prosecutors and the defense attorneys tried to explain we shouldn't be doing in-person jury trials in criminal cases because of the confrontation clause, you know, like you don't want to be doing a Zoom meeting, you know, and there's a lot of things that people don't sort of think about when it comes to a Zoom meeting and for confrontation clause problem. What if the person, your Zoom is only showing you X amount of space? You could have someone sitting beside you writing stuff down. Say this. You won't know for sure. It's the same kind of, from the analogy outside the criminal context, the same kind of thing a lot of people have been dealing with colleges and taking classes at college. Because I know this because my son has just been doing this. And how is he cheating? And they're mad that he might be cheating if someone's in the room when he's taking the class, that kind of stuff. And so the confrontation clause does create a wrinkle in criminal cases that makes it better to try and just do face-to-face. And that's why it's been really difficult. And you have to get sort of waivers and things like that. We actually had a case called Haggard, which was not a COVID case, but it did deal with a Skype witness or a FaceTime witness. who just didn't show up because she didn't want to because she lived in Montana. And that's kind of the where the court seems to be going. It's like, you've got to show some sort of need for this new procedure, because the defendant, Scalia is very adamant about this idea that, you know, the Constitution requires one thing to make it reliable. We don't care about how reliable we think it is. The Constitution has decided what reliability is, and that's face-to-face confrontation. And so the defendant is entitled to that. And so that's why I think that it's been relatively slow in the criminal context to get on board. But I do believe they've done it in situations where I think there's been waivers. But I also think that there have been people that are in prison at the time too. You know, so they're coming in as more people are vaccinated. I feel so bad for all those folks. You know, it's got to be a nightmare to have to deal with all those things, everything grinding to a halt. But hopefully it will get back up. But when they were trying to do, I guess I'll pick up one thread I left. When they were trying to get together with these emergency orders, you know, a lot of the folks on the criminal side were saying, don't do this. We need to, and they just didn't care. Like, they just said, no, it's fine. And then eventually they're like, realized the problem of, well, you should probably get waivers. And so now that seems to be the course du jour, is that they'll do it, but you need to make sure that you're not violating the Sixth Amendment, right? Or if you are violating the right. No, if you are going to try and do this thing, you need to see if the defendant is okay with that. You need to see if he'll voluntarily waive it. But I'm like with everyone else, I can't wait for it to be over. I can't wait for this.
Has your court decided if they're going to go back to in-person arguments in the fall?
I don't know. We have not decided. I would imagine that's going to be the next thing. I don't think we specifically decided that thing. I believe we're going to have our last argument on the 30th of June, and it's still going to be Zoom. But the plan is really September, we are going to go back to normal. And if the thought is we're going to go back to normal, we'll try and see if we can do in-person argument. I mean, the one advantage, actually, I will say this. One of the sort of ironies is, for the longest time, our court didn't videotape oral argument. We didn't broadcast or anything like that. And a lot of people were like, oh, I can't believe the Court of Criminal Appeals doesn't do that. It's like, we don't have a historical society. You know, we don't have Cornell, like, or people going, hey, we're going to give you money, we're going to pay for this, and we're going to put it up there. We never had that. So that doesn't mean that all the judges are okay with videotaping or broadcasting oral argument. But generally, once they gave us the money, we're like, yep, we'll do it. And we did it, and we've done it, and it's been great. We're recording it, we're putting it on YouTube. The problem is that when we get to oral argument in person, it's going to be a little bit different. We were never broadcasting on Zoom, or we never broadcasting on YouTube when we're having the argument live, but Zoom has allowed us to be able to do that. And so Zoom, and because it's all digital already, it makes it easier to get that out there. So we might lose some of our capability by going back live, which is a downside to it, but we'll have to talk about how we're going to work that out. We do have the money. We do have cameras all over the place now, but it requires all sorts of management for us to do that. And so that's another wrinkle that we were going to have to take care of. But I think it's good. I think it's very transparent. I do feel for the United States Supreme Court, though. They don't want to do it. And I'm like, you know, you do you. That's fine. I can see what they're saying. I would be lying if I didn't say, like, well, this is an opportunity to be broadcast to so many people. I'm going to throw some bombs. I'm going to make political statements or something in the middle of the oral argument. And I don't think that that's terribly helpful. And I think that that's what the Supreme Court is probably concerned about, is that you act, you know, that you're going to put on a persona or something instead of really focusing on the law. And so I see both sides of that, but we're looking to continue with what we're doing. And I believe we're going to keep trying to broadcast and make sure everyone can see what we're doing.
You talked about credibility as a court earlier. I mean, I think an advocate who stood up and put on an act like that, I mean, it seems like that would destroy their credibility immediately with the court and with other advocates.
Well, it's funny you say that. One advocate actually did start giving a speech and started turning around to the gallery. And it was like, okay, William Jennings Bryan, you know, like, we're up here. I mean, we've had a lot of interesting things like that. And those are not good advocacy tips. Like, one guy got up and decided that he was a case dealing with a translator, and he spoke in German. He did this whole introduction in German. And the first part of it was like, what is he doing? Right. And then it sort of dawns on us, oh, he's trying to make us feel like, I need to understand what you're saying in German. And so, of course, I don't know a lot of German. I know like one line from like John Kennedy, right? Ich bin ein Berliner.
You knew Schadenfreude.
Yeah, I knew Schadenfreude. I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't even take it. I knew Schadenfreude. And so I waited until my first question, and I said, Ich bin ein Minutenkanzler, which is wrong. It's like, I am a minute, is what I'm saying. But I did that because I was betting that this guy had memorized this thing. And if I tried to get him to continue in German, he would lose it. He would lose his composure. And I was right. It did not go well for him. He just, and so I felt bad for the guy, but I'm like, going, don't, those tricks are not good.
Yeah. Pulling a stunt.
Yeah. Those things aren't going to really help you. You know, we really do care about what your arguments are and we want you to succeed. I had like the flip side of that is I just saw an argument. We just had an argument with a young woman who'd never argued before. And it was obvious that she was nervous because she had to read everything. It was like a complete reading thing. And I don't think for one second that any of us were less than like with her, you know, and considering her argument, you know, because we're like, this poor woman is very nervous. You know, we care about the arguments. We don't care about, you know, we don't care about the theatrics. So I do though. I'm very theatrical. I you know, I'm the only judge that has actually sang from the bench there during oral argument.
I'm sorry. I missed that.
It was one guy got up and he like, this was when Elsa Alcala, Judge Alcala was on our bench, but she wasn't there. And so when you have the setup, as you imagine, it lists all the names of people, you know, and on the podium. And so he starts directing an answer to one of the other judges. And he called that judge Elsa. He's like, I'm sorry, Elsa, or something like that. And then he was mortified because he didn't say judge, right? And then he stammered over a bunch of stuff. And so to try and lighten the mood, I just sang, let it go. Let it go.
I was just thinking that that had to be a Frozen reference.
That's right. That's right. I sang better than I did just now, but I'm like in my house and my wife is upstairs working, so I don't want to belt it out.
So. Well, we've captured this for all posterity now. So
there you go. There you go.
Well, Judge, you've been very gracious with your time, and we sure appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. But you know, it's our tradition before we sign off of one of these recordings that we give our guests the opportunity to share a tip or a war story. The Elsa thing in the German translation, that's a pretty good war story. But did you have a tip or a war story that you wanted to leave our listeners with?
I can just tell you this, like speaking of oral argument, you know, a lot of people talk about the validity of oral argument. I can tell you from experience, don't sweat it, because I have screwed up oral argument worse than I've done everything wrong plenty of times. I think I've had the worst oral argument experience in law school. The second question, I conceded my entire argument at the second question, you know, like it was, that's how nervous I got. But the first oral argument I did in my career was in front of the Court of Criminal Appeals, actually. It was back when Mike McCormick was the presiding judge. And I was going up against Brian Weiss. Okay. Now, again, I mentioned him before, and, you know, a lot of people have feelings about some of his personality, but I can tell you, like, look at his career, look at the stats. This guy has got a lot. He's had a real impact on criminal law. That he can be very proud of. And I'm going up against a top tier advocate. And my boss had said, let's get David to do it. Like I'm like Mikey from life. And so they say like, well, here's what you do. You go stay at the DoubleTree, and that's what you do. So you can walk over there. And so I get a reservation at the DoubleTree, and it's the wrong one. It's the one on the other side of 35. And so I'm now stuck in my little escort trying to figure out, but it's okay. I'm going to park. I'm going to have to do parking. I'm going to try to figure out a way to park at the Capitol. And so I leave early to do this, realizing I'd gone the wrong DoubleTree, and I'm going to try and file something with supplemental case law that, because I didn't work on the brief, my boss had worked on the brief, but I'm going to do the argument. So I go there and I hand these copies. I printed out copies and I hand them to the clerk, and he goes, well, you need two more. You only gave us nine. You need two more copies. And so I'm like, oh, okay, I have a $5 bill, okay, in my pocket. And I have one quarter in the thing. I have no more quarters. I'm already going to have to get money to change this. So I'm like, okay. So I run to the Tom Clark building. I get some guy working at the cafeteria to break my five, give me some quarters. I go and I fill the parking meter, back when parking meters were a thing. And so then I go to the law library to make copies, to make two more copies for this, right? And I put the change into the law library copy machine, and it breaks, okay? And I go to the law library, and I'm like, I wanted the copy. And so they took pity on me, fired up the other one without charging me. So that was very nice. I'm a big fan of the state law library. You know, ride or die. I'm the liaison of the state law library. They do a great job. And so I do that. I come back. I file the stuff. I wander into the courtroom. And, of course, this is the day that they are actually having William King, the guy who was convicted of capital murder for the dragging death in Jasper. So everyone in their family and news and everybody is there. And I'm like, what? you know, and I'm already sweating through my suit and everything. So we finally get ready to go. I finally get up there to go. And I started off with, the court says that we need to, you know, you don't want us to rehash our briefs, so we should try and do things quickly. You don't have to worry about me. I'm in metered parking. And that was it. That was the way I opened my argument. I was lucky enough to win. I did win, not through any great skill on my own part, but that is literally the first words that I said in my oral argument was that. So if I can reach this height, you know, if there's hope for you, there's hope for anyone, you know, just be good at your job and you'll be fine, because a schmuck like me can make mistakes like that. And so that's my big war story about oral argument. Don't sweat it. It's all going to be fine. Just focus on your argument. Everything will be cool. So
I love it.
That's a great one.
Oh, good.
Well, thanks again, Judge. This has been great.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.